What we talked about in 1951, our first episode, was that there was not really a big bang in rock and roll, rhythm and blues, whatever you want to call it. There wasn't one moment where we thought, oh my God, this is music that we're going to hear and it's going to change our lives forever. Well, here we are in 1963, and the big bang, I would argue, is about to happen. You see, we have built up an amazing list of songs. We've talked about a ton of them, over 100, and we've listened to more than that. Songs that are fantastic. They make us dance, they make us sing, they make us feel something. And as we go further and further in time, they make us feel even more. They're even more involved, more complicated, more pleasurable. But here we are in 1963, and as everything builds up slowly, we're about to get hit with an absolute missile. What we're going to hear is the sound of an entirely new form of music. It's when pop and rock converge. And that's going to be the theme of where we go forward here in Hall of Songs. Welcome to 1963.
Sipping through the vinyls at the record store. Hey! Beatles, Elvis, Zeppelin, Chuck Berry, and more. We're searching for the greatest songs around. Well, get ready for the best show in town.
Welcome, music lovers and loyal listeners, to Hall of Songs, the podcast in which two men attempt to determine the greatest songs of all time. I'm Tim Malcolm.
I'm Chris Jones.
And we are here in 1963. It is season two of Hall of Songs. That's right. We're doing seasons now. The first season took us from 1951 to 62, the beginnings of rock and roll, the ramp up in rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and all those sounds. And now here we are at the start of a new dawn. Season two is going to take us into the 1970s as we hear the sounds of pop and rock converging and doing incredible and creative things. Chris, how do you feel about this moment in time that we are about to embark on?
I am very excited about this. I love all the songs we're about ready to talk about in this episode. And it's exciting to get to sort of this explosion of new material here.
So what we do in Hall of Songs is every episode is a new year going forward in time. We started in 1951 and here we are in 63. We give you up to 12 nominees every time out. And those 12 nominees are going to be across the board, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, whatever you want to call it. We don't include some genres, but for the most part, we include all of the music that has been part of our lives. And after each episode, we then put all the songs in a ballot. And then you get to vote for the songs that you think should be in the Hall of Songs. Up to 12 votes you get every time out. As long as there are enough songs on that ballot, you get to vote at hallofsongs.com. After 1 week of voting, we then stop the balloting and we then tell you what song or songs, if any at all, got into the Hall of Songs. Right now, we have 15 songs in the Hall of Songs. We just inducted a new one, a few days ago. And here we are with an entirely new group joining the ballot that has some songs that have been around for quite a while on the ballot. So it's going to be a really fun next week here as we go forward from July 25th into August 2nd or something. I don't know what the heck the last date is here, but we're going to go with it. How you doing, Chris? How are things? How's your life?
I'm good. Everything's going pretty well. It's, you know, it got a little bit cooler here today, so that's nice. How about you?
It's good. I was in Nashville over the last weekend and went to a lot of honky tonk bars and country bars and went to Robert's Western World, which you talked about in our last episode. And that was really fun. Had a beer and a shot and had a bologna sandwich, fried bologna sandwich, and listened to some great covers of they were asking for like country covers. And I was like, Hank Williams, do Hank Williams. And I was like, I'm thinking of you when I'm doing it. So
that's good. Go. I'm glad. Yeah, that's a good place. It's a lot of fun. A classic shotgun bar.
So should we get to 1963? What do you want to talk about here?
1963. What do I always want to talk about, Tim? Baseball, right?
I was going to say The Grateful Dead. I was going to say.
Just Toby wait Keith. Until my 1965 intro.
Oh boy, here we go.
So So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 O. I say O-M, O-M-A, O-M-A-L.
1963. This is the first time that the New York Yankees met the Los Angeles Dodgers in the World Series. The Dodgers, led by Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, made short work of the Yankees. They swept them and held them to a total of 4 runs in the entire series. So, you know, we talked in our 1951 episode that New York was the center of baseball, was the center of everything. And then we've talked a little bit about moving west, but, you know, a decade ago, it would have been unthinkable to have a team in the West Coast. And now the Dodgers are a dominant force on the West Coast, right? They're better than even, you know, the legendary Yankees. And it's not just baseball. Other things are starting to move west. And we've talked about the entertainment culture and, you know, the Los Angeles and California and how things are starting to move west. But this is really beginning to happen in music as well. And in a lot of our discussions, we've talked about the record studios, you know, Atlantic and a lot, particularly in the New York scene. And then we've talked about Motown in Detroit, Stax in Memphis, and the Nashville sound, and, you know, Sun Records and Owen Bradley Studios. But we haven't really talked about Capitol Records and the record labels that were popping up in the West Coast. Capitol Records had been around for a while. It was actually formed in 1942, but most of the acts that were associated with Capitol were, you know, not surprisingly related to the movie scene. And then there were also a lot of great pop acts. I mean, Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, even Dean Martin. There was a huge list of, I would say, pop stars, people who sang standards who were associated with Capitol. But in 1955, Capitol was acquired by EMI, which of course is best known for being the subject of the Sex Pistols song, EMI, but also was the owner of Abbey Road Studios and a huge, huge record studio in the UK, and was, of course, the studio that produced the Beatles. In 1955, EMI terminated its existing distribution agreement with RCA Victor and bought Capitol to make a real imprint in the United States, and immediately built a huge studio at the corner of Hollywood and Vine. And it also commissioned the Capitol Records Tower at Los Angeles Landmark. And, you know, that was called the house that Nat built because of Nat King Cole's role in Capitol Records prior to acquisition by EMI.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out.
So in addition to distributing the Beatles and distributing the British sounds, the Capitol Record became the place for a new sort of rock music in the United States. You know, it's sort of just generically called the California sound. But, you know, what was being made at Capitol Records? It was what? Surf rock guitars, harmony vocals, lyrics that are about surfing, sun, cars, and chasing members of the opposite sex, right? I mean, all those are part of what you'd think of as the California sound. And if it sounds like I just described the Beach Boys, that's not a coincidence. They're one of Capitol's first major U.S. rock artists, and they're the first name probably that pops into your head if somebody mentions the California sound. But I think that the Beach Boys, sort of in a lot of people's heads, are sort of seen as this cartoonish group, when what really the California sound would start to do would become a lot more complex. The Capitol Records and the West Coast studios were willing to experiment with the studio, similar to the ways that the Beatles did at Abbey Road and what we're going to talk about over the next, you know, who knows how many episodes. But the Beach Boys, or at least one of the Beach Boys, were instrumental in this sort of experimental sound and moving away from the rock sounds that we've had in the past. And as part of that, the lyrics also started to move away from this sort of escapism and towards addressing issues of the day. Obviously 1963, the year we're about ready to talk about, is synonymous with the assassination of President Kennedy. It also saw the escalation of the war in Vietnam, all sorts of civil rights struggles, including the arrest of Martin Luther King, the arrest of Sam Cooke and his entire band. And all of these events would go on to shape music in a way and be addressed sometimes explicitly in songs and in songs that we're going to talk about on this show. And, you know, I think what we sort of alluded to in the past is that before this era, the songs weren't exactly apolitical. There's, you know, sexual politics, there's definitely race relations. And I mean, White Lightning is essentially an early libertarian screed, but the rock music and pop music wasn't necessarily expressly addressing the issues of the day. And that's about ready to change. And I think one of the driving forces behind that change is the California sound and this sort of freedom to experiment in the studio, to be a little bit more risky with the lyrics and to actually, you know, speak of the issues of the day. So that's what we're going to start to hear in 1963. And I mean, it's going to continue through the present day, right? I mean, this is where I think 1963 is the first time that we might hear that so expressly, but it's huge. This is where music is going
to
go.
I'm excited to get into it. I know you're excited to get into it. 1963's nominees for the Hall of Songs. We have 12 of them, and let's waste no more time. Let's do it. Well, there you go. Speaking of the California sound, just what Chris was talking about, here is our first nominee from the Beach Boys. It is their seminal surfing song from March of 1963, Surfin' USA.
This one, you know, we will give a little peek behind the curtain. We went back and forth about what songs to include on, and this one actually, I think listeners will be surprised to hear that this one bounced on and off the list. It was not a no-brainer. The more we prepared for it, the more that the sound of this one did win me over. I really like, you know, sort of the pace of it. It's a fun song to listen to in a lot of ways. And we'll talk about sort of the writing of it. But I like a couple little things about it. I love the little sort of organ break and then followed by a guitar solo. And it was Brian Wilson who played the organ on that one. And he does just a great job. And like both the organ solo and the guitar solo, I think are the perfect length and sort of the perfect complement to the melody here.
Yeah, it's a relatively innocuous song, right? But I think of all the surf songs that we've heard, or you know, in our planning of everything, we've listened to a lot of surf songs. This is the most recognizable. It's the most quintessential, and I think it is the most fun. Even though it's really not their song at all.
No, I mean, of course. So should we talk about who the Beach Boys are? We can. I mean, the Beach Boys are the Wilson brothers, right? Brian, yeah. Dennis, and Carl Wilson, and then their buddies El Jardine and Mike Love. Their dad was he the manager? He was the manager. He was sort of, you know.
Yeah, or he was. He was the guy early on pushing the group. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're from California. They're from Southern California. And, you know, this is what they did. They sang songs early in their career about surfing and about having fun. And they'd been around for a couple of years. I mean, they've been around since 1961, at least. I mean, that was when their first real album came out, but this was the one that really captures their sound. But of course, it wasn't even really their sound to some extent, right?
Right. Yeah. So Chuck Berry's Sweet Little 16, if you listen to that, it's the same song. Sweet Little 16, Chuck's talking about how everywhere in the country is going after this 16-year-old girl. But this song is about how there's all these surf spots, you know, everybody's surfing USA and these in these surf spots. And what I think is hilarious about this is they shout out like 20 California surf spots, and then one from Hawaii, and then I think one from Australia. So what are we doing here? Like, what's the point of this, you know?
Everything about these lyrics is just completely inane, right? Yeah. I mean, the first line is, if everybody had an ocean, yeah. Which is like, I mean, I guess the idea is like, you're supposed to have access to an ocean, but it begins with that, and it only gets a little bit more inane after that. But I think that's part of the fun. The more you sort of listen to it and singing about bushy, bushy blonde hairdos and like, I mean, it is a fun song to listen to. And like I said, there's part of me that didn't think that this was necessarily, you know, one that should have made the cut, but listening to it more and more, it's a classic of American, you know, rock and roll. And it's a classic of this genre.
Tell the teacher we're serving. Surfing USA. Hang your knees and fall. Inside, outside, USA. Pacific Palisades. Inside, outside, USA. Seminole for Yancey.
Well, also, we've had Dick Dale twice on this nominee list with Let's Go Trippin' and Miserloo. And he kind of is one half of the surf rock craze, where he's doing the, you know, really fast guitars and the really like speedy rhythm and the sound of sort of being tumbling around in the waves, that kind of thing. And then you have the Beach Boys on the other side, which are really romanticizing the beach, romanticizing being with a female on the shore, that kind of thing, romanticizing the fun and sun. And so I like the fact that we have those two halves being represented here. And, you know, they did take some pages from Dick Dale, their first album, which had Surf and Safari on it, that also has a cover of Miserloo on it. It has a cover of Let's Go Trippin' on it. Is it as good as Dick Dale's? No, absolutely not. The Beach Boys aren't really known as players, although, as you said, Brian Wilson played the organ, and I love that organ break in this song. And what I love about that is in the liner notes of this album, Brian Wilson credits himself as leader, which is perfect. It's just perfect because he is the leader. He is the Beach Boys. He is the one I always think of. Not anybody else. Not anybody else.
All right, it's that band again. It is the Beatles from March of 1963 with Twist and Shout. You know you look so good, I'm so good. You know you got me going now, got me going.
Just like I knew you would, like I knew you would. All right, so before we get into the discussion of the song itself, I want to make a disclaimer, and I think Chris will agree with me on this. The Beatles are our favorite group. That is lock, stock, and barrel favorite artist of all time, the Beatles. He's talked about his tattoo. I don't have a tattoo. I don't like tattoos, but they are our favorites, right? So we're going to try not to do the emotional thing or the hagiography, any of that stuff. We're going to limit that almost to zero as much as possible as we talk about the band, because it's just not, it's going to take too much time. Also, Beatle history, there's such a mythology about it. It's just so much, and maybe you've heard it probably a lot, and you've heard the stories behind these songs. We are going to do that because we talk about the stories behind the songs as well. We'll try to limit that as well. It's hard with the Beatles, so stick with us. If you're not a Beatles fan, which, gosh, boy, stick with us. But nonetheless, I just want to say right out the bat, we're trying to keep the emotional stuff really to a zero here. Nevertheless, this song rocks, doesn't it?
Well, it's fine. We both had this one when we started to cull the list off of the list. And I think we both were saying, well, it's close, but it's, then the more you listen to this, the more it just really does rock. And it just, everything about it, the whole vibe of the song comes off perfectly. And it's just a great, great recording.
So here's a story behind Twist and Shout as we catch you up with the Beatles this time. So Love Me Do was a moderate success, number 17 in Britain. The Beatles played a whole lot around Liverpool, where they're from, and parts of England. And they then met their new manager, Brian Epstein, who got them going back in the studio. And with George Martin, who was their producer, they did a follow-up single. And Martin wanted to do a song called How Do You Do It? That was not written by them. They were like, let's do something else. They did record How Do You Do It? But they did actually do their own song called Please Please Me, which is more of a Roy Orbison-style song that was originally slowed down, but then they sped it up. And that, of course, became their big breakout number one hit in Britain. How Do You Do It, by the way, was number one song for another band. But, you know, they were like, nah, we don't want to do someone else's song. George Martin wanted them back in the studio as soon as possible. And they wanted to capitalize off of what they were doing on stage and the number one record. So they had EMI Studio, which we talked about, in Abbey Road in London, booked for a full day. And they had George Martin had them run through their entire live repertoire, including originals and covers of modern songwriters like Bacharach and Goffin King. The result recorded over 585 unbelievable minutes on February 11, 1963, and including four previously recorded tracks, is the album Please Please Me. And the story of this song is that John Lennon was running a cold, potentially even had the flu. Despite chugging tea during the course of the day, he was losing his voice and composure pretty fast. So at around 10:30 at night, the Beatles recorded this song, cover of Phil Medley and Burt Russell's Twist and Shout that the Isley Brothers had done just the year before. With a little left in the tank, Lennon just screamed the vocal over two takes, shredding his voice in the process, but giving what I think is a definitive, exciting, incredible performance.
And all of that comes through in the recording. I mean, it really, you can feel this late night energy. And instead of sort of going with that, you know, blues club, smoky, you know, sort of down, it's the opposite. Just burst all the energy that is left, pour it all into this one final recording, into this one track. Lennon's vocal performance is just great, but the whole sound of it, I just love, and all of the energy that is there. And it feels like just pushing through, you know, a late night and then still, you know, having fun and still going for it. And I mean, I just love the way that it sounds. And and again, Lennon doesn't even sound like himself. It's not, it doesn't sound like his vocals and a lot of other ones. I mean, it's because of the cold, but it's also just because of the screaming, the everything that he gives and pours into it.
I always kind of thought this song was overhyped. I always thought, oh, people just, you know, Beatles, you know, because they are the Beatles, people just say this is one of the greatest recordings of its time and whatever. And so I always kind of kept it down on my list a little bit. But then, as you said, hearing it in the context of the other songs that came before it and rock and roll and stuff, I mean, it really does jump out. Lennon's vocal is super fun. And George Martin even said it himself, the quote from him, which I think is a great quote. And it's at the end of this Please Please Me session, 585 minutes worth. He says, quote, "I don't know how they do it. We've been recording all day. And the longer they go, the better they get." Very true. It's just an amazing performance. Next up, we have certainly one of the most influential songs that you will ever hear. It is Louie Louie by The Kingsmen.
So we may slightly disagree on this one as far as where we come out. I absolutely love this song. When we were doing the, you know, our list, this was the, you know, to use the expression from my British friends, this was the first name on the team sheet for me. Mm-hmm. There was no doubt that this absolutely had to make the list. And I have listened to this song, I don't know how many thousands of times in my life, and it blows me away every time, from beginning to end. I mean, particularly the moment when it sounds like he actually forgets the vocals and they just keep playing and going through with the recording. It's like everything about the energy of this song just blows me away. And I just think it's this quintessential rock song.
Yeah, I've never been a huge fan of Louie Louie. I'll be completely honest. I think it's the DIY nature of it, the garaginess of it. I like polish. You know, I mean, if you've heard the podcast enough, you probably know I really like the Brill Building stuff. I like Motown. I like rhythm. You know, I like really strong polished rhythm. This feels to me like a lot of noise. But with that said, I real recognize real, right? This here is an outstanding, influential recording that is innovative, that is exciting, that, as you know, as you said, like it just leaps out. It's vibrant, and it's kind of tidy. Like, I mean, even though they kind of lose track of it a little bit here and there, there's still a tidiness to it that I think does inform punk and does inform groups like the Ramones later on.
Yeah, that's fair. And it really is. There is a punk vibe to this that, you know, I think is undoubted. And I don't know too much about, I did not know too much about the Kingsmen themselves before we started looking into this a little bit, because at some point it was, you know, once you've done Louie Louie, what else do you need to do? You know, I mean, I know that they have done a couple other songs from here and there. I knew that they were from Portland, Oregon, but I did not know really anything about who they were or, you know, much else. But it's, again, when you do this, I mean, that's, you've contributed enough to rock.
Isn't that a cool thing though, is that we've had a couple nominees now from the Pacific Northwest that are really just cool. Like, why, like the Fleetwoods, remember that? Like, yeah. Just really, you know, I didn't know the Northwest was like that neat a scene. This was written by Richard Berry, who is inspired by Ricky Rilera and the Rhythm Rockers track El Loco Cha-Cha. The original takes from a cha-cha with a 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2-3 beat. singer Rockin' Robin Roberts, not the pitcher Robin Roberts from 1950s. He got to it in 1960 with his band The Wailers, not Bob Marley and The Wailers, and made it 1-2-3-4, 1-2, 1-2-3-4. But then the Kingsmen, a Portland, Oregon band, as you said, took it on and went back to the original cha-cha beat while being more inspired by Rockin' Robin Roberts with the total package of it, the vocal of it especially. The Kingsmen here are guitarist and vocalist Jack Eli and drummer Lynn Easton, childhood friends. Also in the band is Don Gallucci, a keyboardist, Mike Mitchell, a guitarist, and Bob Nordby, a bassist. Eli is nearly screaming at times in this vocal. He's kind of set back behind the mic like this, but he's screaming all the time. So it's kind of interesting there. And he's also wearing braces, which apparently had something to do with his voice.
Yeah, I have no idea what he's saying half the time in and it doesn't matter at all. It still is great. I like to listen to the lyrics in these. We mentioned in Surfing USA some of the inane lyrics, but that was, you know, part of the fun. This is just, it doesn't even matter what he's saying at all because it's just, you know, it's just noise to some extent. But the sound that underlies this to me is, of course, the organ that's played there. And this is a German keyboard called the Hohner Pianet that was... was invented right around this time. It was early 60s and hadn't really shown up in any rock songs before, but it was really easily portable. It was small. So it was really great to sort of, you know, take to shows and then to drag into studios and things like that. It wasn't a huge lift. And this was really the first use of it, but you can hear this if you listen for it in some Beatles songs that are coming up, and Manfred Mann would use it in particularly the Zombies. And listen to a couple of the Zombie songs, beginning 64, 65, go dig out some of those and you can really hear the Hohner and that sort of that sound. And I really think that sound really adds to the frenetic energy of the song as well. All right, our next nominee from May of 1963, we have Stevie Wonder with Fingertips Parts 1 and 2 live.
Little Stevie Wonder. Welcome to the nominee list, Little Stevie Wonder. This will not be the last time Stevie Wonder gets in our list, I'm sure. We were kind of vacillating on this one back and forth on this. We didn't quite know if it really lived up to it, but ultimately there's an impact here and it was a popular recording and it makes Stevie Wonder who he is.
It's amazing. I mean, his whole story is really incredible. I mean, he's born in Saginaw, Michigan, 1950, and he was premature. And so they put him on oxygen. And what they think is the case is that the excess of oxygen combined with pre-existing condition because he was premature caused him to go blind. So he's blind essentially from birth, moves from Saginaw to Detroit in 1954 and sings with his church choir and learns every instrument you can imagine. I mean, he's playing piano, he's playing drums, he's playing harmonica, and he continues to do this through his entire career. He's basically, you know, he is the one man band. In 1961, Ronnie White of the Miracles discovers him and gets him an audition with Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy hears him, I think once, and is like, oh yes, we're going to sign you, and immediately dubs him Little Stevie Wonder. And he is now signed to Motown, and that's where we are at this point.
Yeah. So he recorded a few albums early on just to get his feet wet. I think they just wanted to kind of get him used to being in a studio. He was 9-10 years old doing this stuff. His first official record was 1962's The Jazz Soul of Little Stevie. And that includes a studio recording of Fingertips, which is only about 3 minutes long. It's Fingertips Part 1. It was written by Henry Cosby and Clarence Paul. He then joined the Motortown Review, which was basically a traveling show of all the Motown musicians in the Chitlin' Circuit. May 1963, 12-year-old Stevie on the Motortown Review performs a rousing 20-minute set at the Regal Theater in Chicago, and included is Fingertips, part one. He goes off on his own, though, and gets into part two, which is the "Everybody Say Yeah" part. And then, of course, the next 3 minutes are him just vamping and having a good time, and then he finishes, but then he comes back, and it's just – it's. This is Stevie Wonder personified, and here comes the next 60 years of music.
And just, yeah, just teasing the audience, playing with the audience, teasing his own band and everything. I mean, it's great. And you mentioned that we went back and forth about whether or not to include this, in part because it's so much about the performance and not as much about the song. In the song, it's a written form as much. But of course, in looking back, you know, I had to say, we've got to put this one on. I mean, this is the first jam band song, the more I think about it. I mean, he just goes into stuff. And not only is it a jam song, but he does the tease. You know, it's like, this is the jam band thing where in the middle of a song, you start to play something else and he goes into Mary Had a Little Lamb. I mean, if this was a Phish set list, it would have Fingertips part one with an arrow into Fingertips part two. And then there would be an asterisk. And at the bottom, it would have Mary Had a Little Lamb tease. So it's got me thinking, and you know, I mean, you'll hate this, but I went down a little rabbit hole and learned that Phish teased Mary Had a Little Lamb in the second set of the Clippered Ball right before going into Split Open and Melt. So this is directly influential. I mean, this leads directly to Phish.
So maybe we shouldn't have had this after all the nominee list. The harmonica is great, right? Like, I think obviously the part two where he goes off is like really fun, but that part one is a really cooking sort of fun jazz groove that they're into. And that harmonica is just so fun and bright and joyful. That's his weapon for the first 10 years of his career. And it really is an outstanding harmonica. He's a great harmonica player.
It is. The harmonica sound really is amazing because it's so gotten overused maybe in rock and pop songs as just sort of this little compliment and not something that really carries the melody like it does here. That's a great sound. Everything about this just sounds fun.
Let's stay with the Motortown Review and the July 1963 hit from Martha and the Vandellas. It's Heat Wave. So this is our first Holland Dozier Holland, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So this is written by Brian Holland, Lamont Dozier, and Eddie Holland, legendary Motown writing team. Surprising maybe that we haven't had any by them before, but this is pretty early in their career and not our last, I would venture to say.
No, probably not. I think this is what you would call like the first true blue Motown sound kind of song, right? We've had Motown so far building up. The sound has gotten better. It's gotten cleaner. It's gotten, you know, the studio work has been better. The production's been better. Do You Love Me by the Contours, which was our latest inductee to the Hall of Songs, is kind of a weird left turn for Motown, but there's a lot of innovation with that one. This sounds like Motown. This is the first one where it's like, oh, there it is. That's the sound. And it's fantastic. I mean, this thing cooks. This sounds like a heat wave. It's just that moving and that burning.
Does. And these guys are from Detroit as well, right? They were formed in Detroit, originally sort of a vocal group, so a doo-wop type group with Rosalind Ashford, Gloria Williams, and Annette Beard. And then they changed members here and there. And then Martha Reeves took over and became the lead vocalist.
Sarif tried to do some solo work. She was recruited to audition for Motown, and she showed up on the wrong day for the audition. So they were kind of mad at her, but then they said, all right, why don't you just like stay here and be an administrative assistant, kind of just help us, you know, schedule things and stuff like that. So meanwhile, she was still singing with her. She went back to her old group, the Vels, they were now called, and was doing background vocals at Motown through them because she was able to book the artist now. So she could book herself to do some background vocals. And it led to a recording session where one of the singers with the Vels, the lead singer, Mary Wells, she was sick. And Martha stepped in, was so good, and that Berry Gordy said, you know what? We're going to sign you guys, and you're going to be the lead vocalist of this group. Williams left after that, and so it was just Reeves, Ashford, and Beard, and so Berry Gordy renamed them the Vandellas and then made them Martha and the Vandellas. So they had one hit before this, Come Get These Memories, which was also written by Holland Dozier Holland. That was the number 29 hit. This is their follow-up, and again, what a hit. What a big one this is.
Yeah, huge hit. Number four on the Hot 100, but number one on the R&B chart, and it would go on to sell a million copies. The sound of this, as you said, I mean, it's just amazing. And it's one that when we're doing the prep for this, that every time I hear it, it sort of blows me away as far as how current it still sounds and the just the lovely sound of it. It's got the Funk Brothers doing the backing work. The percussion here is undoubtedly a gospel style, but it's sped up to just sort of drive it along. And there's also some sort of jazzy elements to the whole production. I love the saxophone going on in the background. This is Andrew Terry on the sax, and it kind of holds everything together here and there, and then just explodes when he plays that in the solo. And it's not, you know, this like long thing that you're going to necessarily be singing along to, but I think it's, again, it's the perfect complement to what else is going on in the song. I also love the call and response vocals. I just think that that's this great interplay. We've talked about that a little bit in the past in some other songs, but really putting that to use and not just having it be a, you know, the strict, you know, one person says A, the other person says A. They sort of play around with some of the possibilities here, and just love that. All right, moving on to August of 1963, that is the Ronettes with Be My Baby.
Let's start with Ronnie Bennett. So the Ronettes were Veronica Bennett, who of course went by Ronnie, her sister Estelle Bennett, and their cousin Nedra Talley. They got an audition with Phil Spector in 1963, early in the year. And from that moment, not only were the Ronettes a group that Phil Spector wanted to have around to sing, but he also wanted them around to have a little fun with. He had some sparks with Ronnie Bennett. So this was written by the husband and wife team, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich. They wrote a whole lot of songs that Spector did from the Wall of Sound. The Do Run Run Run, Chapel of Love, Do Wah Diddy Diddy. I don't know if that was his, but Leader of the Pack. That's, of course, a big time Spector song. They divorced in 1965, so that stinks. But they kept working together, even worked with early Neil Diamond. And the song apparently was inspired by the budding attraction between Phil Spector and Veronica Bennett.
But this is our first Wrecking Crew sound. And Hal Blaine would go on to play drums on countless, I mean, literally countless numbers of hits over the next several decades. And at some point, I think it might be easier to start naming songs that Hal Blaine does not play drums on because we're over the next couple of years, because it's going to get to be that bad. But it's just this great, great studio sound. And, you know, we've talked about Phil Spector, but this is really his sound, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, let's be real. This is an amazing, amazing recording, and I love it a lot. It is one of those that you ask a lot of musicians, they will tell you this is right up there as one of the greatest recordings of all time. Things I love about it. You got the beat that we get from Mr. Hal Blaine. It sounds like a heartbeat that's in love. You know, it's skipping and then speeding. And then it's unexpected at times. And it just has this great vitality to it. The hook, the hook, the beat on the two is the kick drum really far back and deep in the mix. And it reminds me of the drums in Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On album, which is weird. But I don't know. Maybe they took some sort of influence from this or inspiration from this. But the strings are cinematic. Ronnie's vocal is pleading and yet innocent and no perfect. It's a wall of sound recording, but really what I like most about the whole package is that there's a lot of space. You know, the wall of sound can be a little cacophonous, but here there's room to breathe. There's room for Ronnie to do her thing. There's room for the drums to really stand out. It is this really beautiful sort of flower of a recording. And it's no secret that, I mean, like I said, so many musicians just love, love, love this one.
And among those is, of course, Brian Wilson, who would say this was his favorite record ever. And then in later interviews would go on and say that when he was really dealing with mental illness, he would play this over and over again. And he would say that it drove him crazy because he thought he could not write a song that was as good as this. And, you know, amazing statement for somebody like Brian Wilson to say that and to have this be such a huge, you know, part of his existence, I guess.
And, you know, part of that, I think, is also just the lyrics too. Save me, my darling, you know, like these little things like that, these little phrases, save me. There's a lot. That's a loaded term there. You know, we're talking about someone who wants this guy to like them, right? Wants them to be with this guy and, you know, things like save me and, you know, we'll show them, we'll let them see, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of me against the world. There's a lot of I'm in trouble. There's a lot of darkness within the lyric sheet here. And I mean, obviously, you know, Phil Spector, right? I mean, there's darkness there, right?
There is. And of everything, I mean, we've talked about how horrible he was. He essentially tortured Ronnie Spector, kept her prisoner, and, you know, effectively tried to ruin her life. Fortunately, he did not succeed. Ronnie Spector's still alive, and she actually ended up singing backup vocals on Eddie Money's Take Me Home Tonight, which I knew she sang the backup vocals on that, but it never really hit me that was just sort of, they took the chorus and played around with it and did that. And then Eddie Money brought her in to sing backup. It's great.
But, you know, like that's what I was talking about with the musicians loving the song. And I would imagine that Eddie Money was writing Take Me Home Tonight, which is a good song. I mean, I love Take Me Home Tonight. It's fun, but you do get to that chorus and it's kind of stilted. It's kind of forced, but also Eddie was probably like, no, I want to, like, there's a moment here. We got to do the Be My Baby thing. And we got to get Ronnie Spector to come in and sing it. And it's got to happen. And it was still a hit. So, hey, Eddie, congratulations, buddy. Well, that brings us to the halfway mark. We are halfway through the nominees for 1963, and we just want to take a moment here to tell you that our website, hallofsongs.com, has every one of our episodes. You can also find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Spreaker, Amazon, Google. Anywhere you find podcasts, you can find Hall of Songs. And you should go back in time because we have some really great episodes. Of course, every year from 1951 up until right now, 1963, we talk about all the songs that we've nominated from those years in those episodes. We also have some great bonus episodes, don't we, Chris?
We do. You can find us talking about a lot of things. There's a bonus episode where Tim talks about the Grateful Dead. That's pretty amusing. There is a conversation with Justin Gossman from the TCB cast. It's all about Elvis. You can listen to all of our results shows. If you go to our website, you'll know what got in, but that doesn't mean it's not still fun to listen to us talk about those songs and how we react to the songs that got in and those that didn't. And I would say at some point soon, we are going to talk about the Beatles. We'll do a big Beatles deep dive, and you all should listen to it, but maybe that'll be a good place to isolate some of the Beatles conversation for people who don't feel like hearing a real deep dive into the Beatles.
Well, you can please give us feedback. I really would love to hear feedback from you, the listener. Email us at hallofsongspod@gmail.com. We really want to build this thing up even more. We want to do a lot more with this podcast. And who knows, maybe we'll do new podcasts after this. Who knows? We'll see how good everything gets here. Nevertheless, just like email us, hallofsongspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. Let us know what else you want us to do or whatever. We just want to hear from you listeners. And we want to know that there is people out there who love to listen to our podcast. And of course, leave a 5-star review, a 5-star rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. Please do that because that helps us get more listeners. And we would love to get that. And finally, go to hallofsongs.com right now to start voting for the 1963 ballot, plus all the other songs that are still on the ballot from years past. Let's get back to the show.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas?
Welcome to the Hall of Songs nominee list, Robert Allen Zimmerman. Yes, it's Bob Dylan with his August 1963 song, Blowin' in the Wind.
Must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
So here we are. Bobby is here. How do we feel about Bob Dylan? Overview of Bob Dylan for you. How do you feel?
This is going to be fun to talk about Bob Dylan. I mean, he's going to pop up, I think, so many times over in different periods and in different ways. This is obviously a great start to have for Bob Dylan. It's interesting. I'm reading about him. You know, I think everybody knows he's from Minnesota and that he would go to New York City and start playing the clubs there. I didn't realize, I guess, how much in his early, when he talks about his early musical career, how much he sort of plays up his relationship with some of the rock and roll greats like Elvis and Little Richard as his early influences. And it'll be interesting, I think. I'm going to try to listen to that a lot as we hear more and more of his songs in the future years and hear, you know, what kind of influences he took from them. Because at least in my head, he's always, particularly in the early years, so associated with folk music.
Yeah. It's funny because he does do folk for the first couple years, but it's not really that long from now that he goes electric and, you know, turns, you know, the folk world on its axis and makes everybody really upset at him and all that stuff. They get over it because he's Bob Dylan and people realize that, oh, electric music is really good. But you know, it's funny how, you know, people think of Bob Dylan as this folk guy for a very long time. It's really not that long.
Right. I mean, this is his second album. So he's born in Duluth, Minnesota in 1941. He changed his name from Robert Zimmerman to Bob Dylan when he was at University of Minnesota. He took his last name from the first name of Dylan Thomas. And like we said, he moved to Greenwich Village and he started playing the clubs and the cafes there. He was signed by John Hammond and his first album came out the year before this in 1962. And on initial release sold 5,000 copies. I mean, to me, that's just amazing to think about that. But they stuck with him and recorded an album full of originals, which is this. It focused on protest songs and other, you know, folk songs. And this album was the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, released in 1963, and was his breakthrough.
So this one is inspired by the Old Testament, the Book of Ezekiel. And that's the whole like question format, you know, how many roads, all that stuff. That's that. And then a black spiritual called No More Auction Block. And it's very clear when you listen to the lyrics here, I mean, that it is okay. We're talking about really a lot of things that are civil rights related in the 1960s. But this is really a song about being a good human and what it means to be a good human and, you know, the things that you're trying to figure out as you are a human.
Yes, how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died?
This, by the way, is like an immense leap in lyrics. We have had I mean, what was the most lyrically brilliant song that we've had so far? Up on the Roof, maybe, or, you know, I Like Summertime Blues by Mr. Cochran, Eddie Cochran. This is like light years ahead.
Yeah, this is the first song where it clearly was so lyric driven as opposed to just coming up with lyrics that could fit the melody, fit the, you know, fit what was going on. I mean, there is a point to be made with this song, and that point is it comes through loud and clear through the lyrics. And I guess the other one that I would think of, which is right along these lines, would be If I Had a Hammer. And along those lines, Peter, Paul, and Mary were the ones that turned this into a hit. This wasn't a hit for Dylan, but Peter, Paul, and Mary recorded this, and it made it all the way up to number two, where it got stuck because it was behind Fingertips.
So we have 60 years now of Bob Dylan vocals, and, you know, he has run the gamut of vocal performances. This vocal, very different. How do you feel about it?
It's great. I tend to like Bob Dylan singing, I think, more than most people that I talk to, particularly people who are casual. But I do think that over time, it sort of has its ups and its downs. These early songs, I really think his vocals, his voice matches these songs perfect. It's like he does not have to, it doesn't sound like he's trying too hard, but it still matches perfectly what he's trying to do. It is a perfect match for this song. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, 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 yeah. You think you've lost your love? All right, it's the Beatles. I've heard of them. This is also from August of 1963. It is She Loves You.
Woo! What I love is that Paul got that from the Isley Brothers and stuff. I mean, he was like taking a page from the R&B records from the late 50s to do that. I mean, they were pulling from a lot of places, even this early on to make this kind of early sound.
They really were. I mean, we talked, I guess, in some of our episodes about Little Richard, about the influence that Little Richard would have on the Beatles. I don't think we necessarily said that when we were talking about the Isley Brothers and Shout, but they were listening to all those songs that we were talking about during those earlier episodes and putting them all together into one thing to make this. I mean, this is just sort of an explosion of all of these different types of influences, and that they all come together just perfectly. I've always loved in this song in particular. I mean, it goes for several of the earlier Beatles songs, but I love it in this one, the way that some of the guitar sounds are slightly discordant, and that there's a little bit of shouting. I mean, like, you know, when Paul does the shouting and some of the yelling, but then they can just shift back and get exactly on, you know, exactly on rhythm and exactly in tune and do perfect harmonies. It's almost sort of what people say about great artists, that the like great visual artists, where they could paint something perfect, but they choose not to. They want to make it more interesting by doing that. And it's almost always to me as if the Beatles were saying, we could do this perfectly. We could hit every note, but we choose not to, because it's better if we just miss occasionally.
Ringo's drumming. Like I always kind of didn't give Ringo credit with anything ever. He's the number four guy, whatever. You know, all the other Beatles can get, you know, $5,000, he can get 250, whatever. But his drumming is really, really good. I mean, he's hard on the beat, but he keeps time really well and has this really fast kind of swaggering shuffle going on the whole time that you just can't help but just like move to. It's really, really phenomenal stuff.
Yeah, you beat me to that, because I've always really liked Ringo's drumming and thought that he's far from the perfect drummer, but that he was the perfect drummer for the Beatles. And that was not an easy role when you're matched with McCartney playing bass. I mean, you're in a rhythm section with somebody who's essentially playing lead on the bass. And it has to be, you know, near impossible to try to keep up with that and to try to do that. So Ringo doesn't. Ringo does his own thing, and he drives the songs in a different way. And I just feel like he complements Paul's bass perfectly, and he complements the rhythm guitar perfectly as well. And it's his drums are almost playing with the vocals as opposed to playing with the bass, which is this great sort of dynamic that I think makes the Beatles sound different from day one.
Also, we'll talk about this with possibly another nominee coming up later. There's a couple different things happening at the same time in the song. You know, each instrument has their own role to play here. And Paul's bass is playing this chord progression that to me feels very uneasy right from the get-go. And it casts to me this sort of harrowing message for the guy who they're talking to in the song. You know, everybody talks about how this song is not about I love you. It's about, hey, she loves you, dude. You should go get her. But to me, there's sort of this element of, dude, you're a screw up. And by the way, I already got her. And that to me is what that bass line is doing. There's a darkness to this song that you're not getting. I mean, there are multiple layers to this particular song that we don't get in mostly any other song up until this point.
You know it's up to you. I think it's only fair. Why can't her to do? Apologize to her. Because she loved you. And you know that can't.
That's right. I mean, it really is a dark undercurrent to the sound of this. Not to the vocals necessarily, but no. To the sound of it that is unexpected, I would say, and it's subtle, but it is definitely there. There's no doubt it was done on purpose, and it's where, again, we're trying to avoid sort of being the Beatles fanboy, but it's where they were doing things that were half a step ahead of a lot of the other music that was coming out around this time.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to.
Welcome to the fall of 1963, and this is our second nominee from the Beach Boys in this very year. And it is the first time that we hear the hints of Brian Wilson really spreading his wings. This is In My Room.
I will admit that in our run-up to this, I may have said some things about this song, and it's perhaps not living up to some of the other songs that the Beach Boys would do down the road. And I regret almost all of that after listening to this more and more. This one just blew me away on repeated listens and has shot to, you know, near the top of my list in 1963. I'm amazed the more I listen to this at the production of it, at the writing of it, at what Brian Wilson was doing here. And this is a good song. This was one that was a shock to me as far as how much I really, really enjoyed listening to this.
We nominated in the Veterans Committee episode previously the song Up on the Roof by the Drifters, which is sort of a hiding place song. It's where you go to get away from it all. And I said that it had a little bit of a meaning to me because I lived in New York and you could kind of feel that sense of like you need a place to get away from it all, right? This song means even more to me, and it has for a long time. So I as a kid, I was not the most social person. I was different from everybody else. I was always in fear of being singled out. I was bullied a lot. I couldn't control the world around me. And what I could control was being in my bedroom, being in my own place where I could create these worlds that I basically inhabited, or I sort of created for, you know, these invisible beings that I thought of. And this song really kind of, you know, connects me to that a lot. Brian wrote this. He suffered from severe agoraphobia. And, you know, this is about his struggles of trying to fit in and be really stressed out about the world around him. So lyrically, it is unbelievably mature. And what is he, 22, 23 at this time, maybe? And then the harmonies of this song are amazing. I mean, it's a 5-part harmony in the hook. You don't get that anywhere else, really. I mean, even the doo-wop stuff that we covered, you know, isn't as lush and as mature as this stuff.
Yeah, I listened to the entire Surfer Girl album. And again, this is sort of at the era where albums are not albums, but where they're collections of songs. But there's 14 songs or something on the Surfer Girl album. And this just sticks out like a sore thumb. But it goes to what I was saying at the beginning about the California sound having a lot more going on than what it might feel like at first blush. I mean, all the other songs on Surfer Girl sound like either fast songs that are all about, you know, cars or surfing, or the slow songs are things that you dance to at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. And this one just is different. I thought this was a waltz at first, looked it up, and it's even, you know, slightly more complex than that. It's a 6-8. And it's like, it just, it doesn't feel like a typical slow song that you would have, or anything else. And that allows, I think, the lyrics to be more personal and to have it sort of be this more, this really more personal, more subtly great song that doesn't try to sort of punch you in the face with, you know, with, you know, we're going to all go surfing, we're going to all jump in my car. It's just, it really is amazing to me that they're doing these things at the same time. And it already in just, this is the first episode we talked about the Beach Boys. I go back and forth a little bit about how much I like the Beach Boys and Brian Wilson in particular, just with the depth, but this one really did blow me away listening to it. And it's, I really have a lot of admiration for the way they're able to put that sound and lyrics together.
If you want to track the vocals on this one, so Brian sings the lead here, which is apt, obviously. Then Carl comes in right off the top. So Brian sings the first maybe couple words, and then Carl comes in behind him. And then Dennis comes in for the line, "Tell my secrets to." And then as they get to "In My Room," Al comes in, Al Jardine, and then Mike Love does the bass. It's gorgeous. I mean, it is a gorgeous sound. And when people talk about the Beach Boys being maybe the greatest vocal group of all time, this is it. This is the song that kind of sets the tone. And there's going to be a couple other songs down the line that are going to have, you know, the same, if not better, vocal performances, and songs that are even, you know, even more to my heart than this one. But this is just gorgeous. It is one of those songs that it'll make you stop. And I hope it makes you stop when you listen to this. It's really that amazing.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right. Have a good time, 'cause it's all right. Whoa.
Moving on, we have The Impressions from October 1963 with It's All Right.
So this is one that we added very late in the game, and we sort of went back and forth on that 12th spot, and this is the one that ended up there. So let's give me your reasoning as to why this should be in the nominee pool.
Curtis Mayfield. I love Curtis Mayfield. No, I mean, this is one that has... it's a really, really, I think, eternal quality to it, where it's, I could have pictured this one from 1956, 57, maybe, but I also could picture it from the 1980s. Sure. With just a couple tweaks here and there. It's really a well-crafted song, and it's written by Curtis Mayfield. And the combination of the vocals are, it's like what you were saying about the Beach Boys being a great vocal group, the Impressions are the same, and they have that eternal sounding harmonies that they could work in any era.
Yeah, so let's go into the bio real quick, and then we'll get back into the song. So the Impressions started out as the Roosters in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The founding members moved to Chicago, and the early lineups included Sam Gooden, Richard Brooks, Arthur Brooks, Jerry Butler, Fred Cash, and Curtis Mayfield. They became Jerry Butler and the Impressions for just a little bit. Butler then left to go solo, and then Curtis Mayfield took over the lead singer position there. As you said, written by Curtis Mayfield, this one, and was a top 10 hit, but they only had two top 10 hits. The other one is it the one from the next year? Is it People Get Ready?
I think it is. Yeah, that's from the next year. Yeah, and it's funny, there's one of the members of the group, I think it's Fred Cash, has a line where he says that Curtis Mayfield would just hear people say things and turn those into songs. And People Get Ready was one of those, and so was this. I guess it was a combination when he was talking to Sam Gooden, and Sam Gooden said something about It's All Right, and he just immediately clicked in his head. He said, that's got to be a song, for whatever reason. I mean, that's just an amazing, I mean, I love Curtis Mayfield. I love his later stuff, and I know we'll at least talk about him much later on when he becomes a solo artist, but I just love those sort of stories about people like that that have that talent to say, oh, that guy just said three words, that's got to be a song.
I'm a learner, so make life your goal, and surely something's gotta come to you
and say it's all right. Say it's all right.
You know my argument as to why this should make the list, and it came to me very late. It came to me after we put it on the list, actually, is Sam Cooke was really the big soul artist that we've had so far. And he represents a very 60s sentiment of soul. There's a sense of pop in it. There's a sense of, you know, melody. There's a sense of sticking with that formula. Curtis, to me, is really informing, even in this performance here, Curtis and the Impressions are informing what 70s soul is going to sound like, that much more sort of deeper and silkier and funkier sort of sound. And maybe it's just we've heard Curtis Mayfield in the 70s so much that I'm just like hearing it now and going, okay, that's what it is. But I don't know. Like this seems like a deeper, more sort of ingrained, more home style kind of soul music that really is going to become soul. Like this is what soul is. This song is kind of the beginning of that. Whereas the Sam Cooke stuff and the Ray Charles stuff from earlier is sort of, it's soul, but it's sort of soul kind of the beginnings of it. This is really the first song that goes, okay, like with Motown and Heatwave, this is the first song that goes, oh, this is soul. And it's going to go from there.
That's right. It really does sort of build on what was going on in the past and take it one step further. And I love sort of the carefree nature of the singing where it's perfect. There's perfect harmonies, but it sounds like they don't even have to try to sing in perfect harmony. They were just born to do that. And it comes across just as a beautiful, beautiful song.
And it's been covered by what, Etta James, and my favorite, and maybe your favorite too, the a cappella cover by Huey Lewis and the News. It's great.
That was a huge hit. I did not realize that. I obviously remember listening to that whole album, but I didn't realize that made it up. I don't know if it was top 10, but it was 10 or 11. It was the Huey Lewis one charted really high.
And they did both It's All Right by the Impressions and It's All Right by, what is it, J.J. Jackson or what's his name?
Yeah, no. That's right. They did it's the other
all
one.
Right. Yeah. All right, girl. You know, that one. Yep. They've done both of those. So I guess Huey just loves
it. If you write a song that has All Right in the title, Huey will cover it.
I will do that now. I love Huey.
Although I don't know if he's ever done All Right Now by, who is that?
By Free. Free.
By Free. Yeah.
There you go. Chris, what time of year is it?
You're not the best with dates, so I'm going to go with December.
That's correct. It is Christmas time, and here is a seminal Christmas song. It is Darlene Love with Christmas, Baby Please Come Home.
So was this the first song where Darlene Love was billed as a solo artist?
I think so. I think it was. And the funny thing is, Ronnie Spector, I guess she was still Ronnie, what was it?
Barrett
at the time. She was supposed to do it herself, but it was too strong for her. And so Phil gave it to Darlene Love.
That's interesting. I looked and I couldn't find any others that were Darlene Love solos before this. So, and it, I mean, she delivers, right? I mean, this is really an unbelievable vocal performance.
Let's go. Let's go. This is one of my all-time favorites. This is a song that I spin every year at Christmas. I spin the whole album, A Christmas Gift for You by Phil Spector. This album is just chock full of amazing songs. Spector wrote it. Ellie Greenwich, Jeff Barry, they wrote so many others. We talked about Be My Baby. But this one is, you know, is, as you wanted to talk about, this isn't quite a Christmas song, though.
You're right. Listening to this song more and more, this isn't a Christmas song. This is a love song. It's a broken heart song that just happens to take place at Christmas. And I was trying to find out, you know, I love Christmas music. I'm a huge fan of Christmas music and always have been, and will listen to all of these. I listen to new stuff. I listen to old stuff. Is when this album, how important it was on the Christmas music sound, where there was, you know, hymnals and more religious inspired music. Then there were some songs that started to have fun, but we're really about Christmas. And then this album is one of the ones that there's this breakthrough with now, where it's like, this is a song that just happens to take place at Christmas, but yet then becomes ingrained in the culture of the United States, because you're going to listen to it every Christmas.
So I'll do this right now. So if you have never heard A Christmas Gift for You by Phil Spector, you have to listen to it. Even if it's not Christmas time, just listen to it. And here are the six songs that I recommend that you listen to most. These are the six musts in ascending order. So number six, Santa Claus is Coming to Town by The Crystals. Very good. Number five, Darlene Love's Winter Wonderland, which is awesome. It's awesome. The drums and the rhythm in that is great. Number four, I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus by the Ronettes. I think a lot of people have heard that one. It's a fantastic version. Number three, Darlene Love Again with Marshmallow World, which became, I think, a thing over the past couple of years. It was a Target commercial, but that's an awesome song. Number two, the Ronettes doing Sleigh Ride, the definitive version of Sleigh Ride. Don't Tell Me Nothing.
Yes, that no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-dong-ding. And number one is this one, Christmas by Darlene Love. I mean, look. I think Be My Baby is the wall of sound that's most calibrated, right? It's kind of, you know, it's the space and everything is like really just so. This is the wall of sound at its highest capabilities. It's noise. And shouldn't being searching for love and being heartbroken in the holidays, shouldn't that be a moment where you're surrounded by all this happy, amazing noise, right? So as Darlene sings about the church bells ringing and the pretty lights and the happy sounds, you know, you hear those things. And what I really think is, like, somehow Phil got this group of guys over however many takes he did and however disciplined he made it. They made them play music that sounded like lights on a tree and sounded like snow falling and all that stuff. Like, it is the sound of Christmas happening around this desperate woman. It's incredible.
Everything about the recording is great. I love the sax solo that right, you know, near the end of the song that goes into the bridge. And it, again, it creates the sort of urgency. I mean, that's the whole thing about the song, is there's this desperation to her vocals combined with the sound, that it's this longing love song that is not going to have a happy ending. It doesn't seem like, but that's what it's sort of why it's there. That's why it works. It's just this brilliant, you know, sound of desperation and packaged just perfectly into this, you know, quote unquote Christmas song.
So to put a bow on this one, Darlene Love didn't really perform the song after this. And I think part of it was the affiliation with Phil Spector, and she got done really dirty by him. And so whatever. But then in 1984, Paul Schaefer starts doing a residency at the Bottom Line called Leader of the Pack. And it's the songs of Ellie Greenwich, who writes a lot of the Phil Spector stuff. And he has Darlene Love come on and perform this song. And David Letterman goes to watch the performance, and he is like, he hates novelty songs. Letterman hates these novelty songs, but he hears this and goes, oh my God, this is an amazing track. It's the greatest Christmas song I ever heard. We need to get her on the show at some point. So in 1986, Darlene Love shows up on Late Night, the original, the Late Night with David Letterman, and performs the song. And from that year on, every year, Darlene performs on Letterman's show. It's one of the greatest things. Every Christmas, I watched it. It was incredible. She was every year she hit it. It was amazing. And the Christmas shows by Letterman, by the way, with Jay Thomas telling the Lone Ranger story and throwing the football at the meatball on the tree. Like, come on. It's great stuff. Miss you, Dave. I wish you were still on. And Darlene Love, you are the best.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh, please.
I promise I did not rig this to get to announce every Beatles song, but they're back with I Wanna Hold Your Hand from November of 1963.
All right, let's get it off the top. I just want to get it off the top. Let's do the whole story here. So the Beatles went back into EMI Studios in the summer of 63 to start recording their second album called With the Beatles. It was supposed to come out before the holidays. Lennon and McCartney wrote this song in the family home of McCartney's then girlfriend, Jane Asher, who was a London socialite and actress and all that stuff. Both Lennon and McCartney confirmed that they wrote the song Eyeball to Eyeball at the piano. And so in October, the Beatles went back to the studio to record I Want to Hold Your Hand with visions of it being a hit. Now that the Beatles were the biggest band in Britain, the next step was making it big in America. The problem was Capitol Records, who we talked about in the very open of the show, was in the US but declined to release the Beatles singles, even though they were owned by EMI, who had the Beatles, you know, as their guys. So Martin, through Parlophone, looked for boutique record labels to get some product out in the US. So that's what happened with She Loves You, From Me to You. Record labels like Swan and VJ and stuff like that would release those singles. In September of 63, in fact, She Loves You was rated and not very high. It got like a 7 on American Bandstand and the record rating. So they weren't ready for it. But by November, British Beatlemania was too strong to ignore. American Nightly Newscast did special reports from the UK on this strange rock and roll phenomenon. And considering many of these reports came out just around the time that Kennedy was assassinated, it offered an interesting juxtaposition. The mourning of America as their president has been killed. And then this amazing band of young kids from Britain who are just like taking the world by storm. So She Loves You has a second life atop the UK charts. I Want to Hold Your Hand comes out in November. Utter chaos in the UK. Epstein's available to convince Capitol to get their act in order and release the single in early 64. But then a teen named Marcia Albert in Washington, D.C. persuades a DJ named Carol James to acquire and then play the record on the radio. James plays it. It's an immediate smash in D.C., and other radio stations across the country start getting their copies on the radio, too. Capitol Records is incensed. They start like telling the radio stations to stop playing it, but it's too late, so they have to give in and release the song early. December 26, 1963, I Want to Hold Your Hand comes out in the U.S. American music has never been the same.
It is December of 1963, where everything goes from the Beatles being this great group and this group that plays raucous concerts to being the greatest cultural force in the world. And it's just about to happen. And we're going to undoubtedly talk about it over our next several episodes. And it's so exciting to hear these songs. And it's exciting to go back and listen to this song in particular and just imagine hearing this for the first time. And it's impossible to do it to some extent, but again, when you're really focusing on everything coming out for 1 year, you can hear that energy and you can hear something that is, you know, it's not different than everything that we've talked about, but it is different than a lot of what we've, you know, a lot of the songs that were out around the same time. And I find it hard to talk about a lot of the Beatles songs, but this one in particular, because it just does feel like everybody knows this song. Everybody knows some of the background of this, even if they don't know the full story. And it is really just this explosion of sound, this explosion of energy that is different than what's come before it.
And when I touch you, I feel happy inside. It's such a feeling that my love
George Martin knew what he was doing, and he was able to, in the recording studio, capture this live sound like nobody else had done before. And they were able to deliver on that in the recorded versions, and then also when they would play this live. And we haven't talked a lot, I guess, about the bands that going way back to what they were like live performances, but this was, you know, maybe the first time that a band was consciously thinking about what they were going to sound like on stage. Sure. When they were in the studios as well. And they knew that this would translate to something that was going to be played in front of a huge raucous crowd.
Yeah. I mean, look, I have tried really hard to be as objective as possible with the Beatles because they are a part of my DNA. They just are. And I've really tried to critique these songs, but ultimately It's the sound. It's the sound of the band live that is captured in the studio and still sounds polished and fresh and, you know, vital. And this is something to keep in mind is that last episode, I mentioned that the Four Seasons were really the first self-contained band that we had featured on the show, the whole show. But let's be real. They were vocalists who happened to play some instruments. They're not great instrumentalists. They're just instrumentalists. That's the word. They're just vocalists who play instruments. The Beatles, though, as you said, you know, they had this live sound. They honed their chops over years in Germany, in England, across Europe. They were really, really good. And they played these songs really well. And not only could they play the instruments well, but they could sing really well too. They were good musicians and good singers. And they wrote clever stuff. And they took from all these different influences and they put it all together and were like, yeah, this is what we're going to do. They are the first great self-contained band ever. You know, I don't think that's talked about enough is that as a self-contained band, they are the first ones, and they happen to be maybe the best ones. So those are our 12 nominees from 1963 for the Hall of Songs. Again, really tough to get to that list, but we have the 12, and they are Surfin' USA by the Beach Boys, Twist and Shout by the Beatles, Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, Fingertips Part 1 and 2 Live by Stevie Wonder, Heat Wave by Martha and the Vandellas, Be My Baby by the Ronettes, Blowin' in the Wind by Bob Dylan, She Loves You by the Beatles, In My Room by the Beach Boys, It's All Right by the Impressions, Christmas Baby Please Come Home by Darlene Love, and I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. Those are the songs that will be on the ballot starting right now. Go vote up until August 2nd. Is that Sunday? Dates. We're looking at calendars.
I think it's August 1st. August 1st.
So up until August 1st, vote at hallofsongs.com for the songs that you think should be in the Hall of Songs. You have up to 12 votes in your ballot, and they join a whole list of songs that include stalwarts on the ballot like Tutti Frutti by Little Richard and relatively new songs to the ballot like Love Me Do by the Beatles and Sherry by the Four Seasons. So go to hallofsongs.com to vote. Okay. This, as I've said many times, has really been hard. And there are a lot of songs that we considered for the nominee list. I'm going to read them really quick and just when we get to the end of it, you want to talk about one or two that you really think should be talked about a little bit more. But here they are. Here are the songs that we considered at the last second, I guess. One Fine Day by the Chiffons, Act Naturally by Buck Owens, Walk Like a Man by the Four Seasons, Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash, Please Please Me by the Beatles, I Saw Her Standing There by the Beatles, Wipeout by the Safaris, My Boyfriend's Back by the Angels, Surf City by Jan and Dean, Da Do Ron Ron by the Crystals, Then He Kissed Me by the Crystals, Glad All Over by Dave Clark 5, Another Saturday Night by Sam Cooke, Little Deuce Coop by the Beach Boys, Rhythm of the Rain by the Cascades, It's My Party by Leslie Gore, and Surfin' Bird by the Trashmen. A lot there. Any that you want to pick out?
I would like to, I'll quickly mention one that I don't think was all that close to making the cut, but is worthy of note, which is Act Naturally by Buck Owens and his Buckaroos. Only because this is the first song that's come up that was really from the Bakersfield sound. And the Bakersfield sound is really the California West Coast answer to the Nashville sound. And it's funny, if you've heard, you know, country music fans will always fight about authenticity. And there was this idea that somehow the Nashville sound had gotten too pop. So the West Coast Bakersfield sound was going to be the retort to that. So it was back to old school honky tonk country. Buck Owens is the epitome of this. He's a great, great songwriter. Merle Haggard is probably the biggest artist to eventually come out of the Bakersfield sound. But a couple things. One, the Beatles would go on to cover Act Naturally. And make it, you know, probably a bigger hit than it would have been otherwise and why more people know it. And then also the Bakersfield sound would sort of join up ultimately with the California sound and lead to a lot of artists that some of my all-time favorites that are ones that we're going to come back to, but not for 10, 12 episodes. Bands like, you know, The Birds and, you know, things like Graham Parsons, even bands like Creedence, where they took these sounds and combined a little bit of it. And so really not necessarily a song so much as a note that sound is starting to come up.
So I want to mention Walk Like a Man by the Four Seasons, which wasn't on my short list, but there's a reason. It's 80% there. The song is essentially two verses, two choruses. There's no bridge. There's no return to a verse or chorus. It's just a verse, chorus, verse, chorus. That said, it's really good. I love Walk Like a Man, and it's almost a definitive Four Seasons song for me. There's a certain swagger that Frankie Valli has in that vocal that is angry, tough. You know, he's telling this woman, he gets the advice from his dad, you know, to finally tell this girl off that's kind of doing him wrong. And then he goes to the girl and he goes, "You done me wrong. You know, I'm going to walk like a man, get out of here." And there's a real swagger. There's a real Jersey sense to it. That's real. It's quintessential for them. That's their song. That's them. But it's just not, I wanted a bridge. I wanted something more. I just wanted something more out of that song to kind of put it over the top. And it wasn't there. That said, it might be a Veterans Committee choice. That said, we got 64, we got 65, we got 66. My God, is it going to be able to stand up to those songs? I have no idea. Well, if you do think any of those songs or anything else from 1963 should be on our ballot at some point, please email us at hallofsongspod@gmail.com. Meanwhile, where can you find us out there in the world? Social media, where can you find us, Chris?
We're on Facebook. Our Facebook page is Hall of Songs. You can find us on Twitter at Hall of Songs. We do have an Instagram account, although we're not exactly active, but that's also at Hall of Songs. And you can email us at hallofsongspod@gmail.com. And our website, of course, hallofsongs.com. And you can always contact us through there as well.
And of course, you can find us on any place that you can find podcasts, but we especially ask you to go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star rating and a review of our podcast. And please do that. If we can get to 25, I'll do this right now. If we get to 25 reviews, we're close, get to 25 reviews, I will discuss a Fish concert.
Oh, an entire concert? I was going to go with one song.
I'm going concert. I'm going concert. I will. This will be my penance. How about that?
I won't even force one of the three setters on you. I'll pick a good, cool, you know, two set tights, you know, tight concert.
Oh, thank God.
Not the Clifford Ball.
Okay. Well, who needs that? Go to our website, hallofsongs.com, to vote right now for the songs that you think should be in the Hall of Songs. Again, up to 12 votes you have, and the ballot is stacked right now. So some really great stuff. Beatles, Beach Boys, Four Seasons, Little Richard's still there, Bobby Darin's still there, a whole bunch more stuff. So go to hallofsongs.com and vote. Thank you to who, Chris?
Stock Music Media for our ever-changing theme song. And thank you to Aaron DeLashmet for our logo work and the cool little guitar pick plaques that you can see on our website every time a song gets inducted into the Hall of Songs.
Our next episode will be, it'll be a recap episode. Maybe we'll do the Beatle thing in the middle there. We're not sure yet. We're kind of ironing that out, but we'll do a bonus Beatle episode very, very soon. But we'll have a recap show on the next round of voting. And then 1964, it's worse than 63. It's harder than 63. This is going to be tough.
This is going to be brutal. There are so many good songs coming up. And, you know, so if you get this, you feel free to reach out and yell at us before we decide what's going to make the cut. We might ignore you, but at least we will, you know, we'll read your emails.
We won't ignore you. No, we need more listeners.
Fair.
Please tell your friends and have them.
We might not agree with you. How's that? We will not ignore you.
There you go. All right. Well, that is it. Thanks for listening to All of Songs. This has been a blast as always. We will come back in 2 weeks with 1964. That'll be on August 8th.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm Tim.
I'm Chris.
Check you later. There he has.